Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. Tonight's show is called Playing with the Brain, Using Cognitive Training Games to Change the Way We Think and Feel. Have you ever wondered how you might ramp up the power of your brain? Indeed, researchers here in the Bay Area have been proving that tools, games, and software can improve many facets of brain health and brain performance. Their research is based on a term called neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain and nervous system in all species to change structurally and functionally as a result of input from the environment. But what are the basic brain mechanisms that make plasticity work? And who can benefit from the cognitive training? And what are the limitations? Joining me to answer these questions and more are, in studio, Dr. Adam Gazzoli, Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry at UCSF. He is also the Director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center, and he is the Principal Investigator of Cognitive Neuroscience Laboratories, studying the neural mechanisms of perception, attention, and memory, with an emphasis on distraction and multitasking. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
I also have Joe Hardy. He is the Vice President of Research and Development at Lumos Labs, a lab and company that is actually building these types of games and trainings. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Welcome, Joe. We also have in studio Annette Urach. She is a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University. Her research interests focus on emotion regulation, its neurological, physiological, and behavioral components. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
And lastly, welcome. First, welcome, Annette.
Thank you, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
And then last by phone, we have Sophia Vinogradov, the Chief of Mental Health Service at San Francisco VA Medical Center and Professor of Psychiatry at UCSF. Welcome, Sophia.
Thank you. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Nice to meet you, Annette.
Nice to meet you,
Hello.
Sophia, too.
And, of course, we'll be taking calls from you. We'd like to hear your thoughts and opinions. So in about 20 minutes, we'll let you know when you can give us a call at 415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So let me start tonight. I'd like to start tonight with Adam Gazzoli, Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry at UCSF. I thought maybe we could introduce the show by talking about the normal brain and what it looks like and how neuroplasticity works.
Sure. Well, we've known for a long time that the brains of children and all developing animals go through a lot of plasticity, and you described it very well. It's that the brain is not static. It changes in response to the environment. For a long period of time, we thought that there were critical periods, and there are, but we thought that these critical periods were fixed, where after that, there was very little change that occurs in the adult brain. And now we know that's not true. A lot of work over the last 20 years have shown us that the brain changes in its structure, its function, its physiology. It changes at the levels of the neurons and how neurons talk together. Neurons are the main functioning brain cell, and the networks of how brain areas interact change as well. So now, with appreciating a lot of this has been driven by tools to study the brain in human beings and in people as they participate in experiments. And the tools for that are things like functional MRI and EEG, where we can look at actual measures of brain activity while people perform studies and maybe do the type of brain training that you described. And so we have a new appreciation now for how plastic the brain is throughout our lifespans, even older adults. And this has led to a lot of excitement in capitalizing on the plasticity that's retained as we age and throughout our lives to see if we can improve people's abilities with very targeted exercises.
So what was it about the brain that made researchers and doctors feel that it was fixed? There were only certain times.
Well, I mean, most of the main changes, especially in terms of the number of cells in the brain, the neurons really reach this level, and then they're relatively constant. If anything, they decrease from the development stage on. A lot of it was also based on you know, anecdotes and that are largely true, that some things are just a lot easier to learn as children, like languages. And we know that the ability to learn rapidly is incredibly robust during development, and it certainly declines. So I think along with that came the idea that maybe it just stopped, but that doesn't seem to be the case, as research has shown.
This is Sophia, and I would add another set of kind of conditions which kind of led to this belief that the brain doesn't change, were some of the clinical conditions like stroke, or if someone had a very severe head injury. People observed that after a stroke or after a severe head injury, if someone lost functions, like they lost their language function or their motor functions and ability to move, those tended not to come back or not to come back very well, sort of leading to the idea that, you know, the brain was sort of this fixed organ that couldn't, in a sense, change very much after it suffered from these severe kinds of injuries.
Okay, great. That's a very interesting addition. What I'd like to do is each of you have a wonderful kind of focus. So let me just go back to you, Adam, and have you tell us a little bit about the aging brain. So that is your focus, mm-hmm. is how people age. So what? Tell me a little bit about what you've learned about the aging brain and how it's your, you know, as you've said, through these MRIs, through the EEGs, you've learned that actually people can control a little more than they thought their demise, if you will, their mental demise.
Sure. I mean, so yeah, how the research in our laboratory works is we first try to understand the things that change, that decrease the quality of our lives and our cognitive abilities. So we in our lab, as you mentioned, focus on distraction, multitasking, how processing multiple streams of information might decrease your memory abilities. And we know that everyone has trouble with distraction, even younger adults, and multitasking. And this gets worse as you get older. So we do these functional MRI experiments, and we can see that older adults have a bigger hit in their performance, their memory, when they're trying to do multiple things at the same time. And so we were inspired by those findings to see if we could develop interventions and games and training programs to see, can these skills be regained? Can we change the brain and also change performance? So we use the same type of tools that we use when we study the brain outside of this training focus. And then we have our participants, our older adults, come in. We have set many studies in our lab that are ongoing now. The participants come into the lab, they do certain experiments, we record their brain activity while they're doing it, and then they go home and they play these games and these training programs, and they come back into the lab and we take a look again and see what has now changed in their brain, what's changed about the abilities that they practiced on, and importantly, has this led to changes in other type of abilities. So that's the approach that we and a lot of other labs take to study plasticity.
And so when you talk about aging brains, how what's the number? How old are people when they come into your lab?
Well, we tend to look at 60 to 80-year-olds, and we tend to focus on healthy older adults, although we have some work with early dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Although, in all fairness, I would describe the aging brain as beginning at like 23 years old. You know, there's a lot of things that change very soon after that developmental phase. And we have new studies in our lab that show, you know, sure, these things are more extreme when you're in your 60s, but we see lots of changes, you know, between 20 years old and 30 years old and 40 years old. So I think the concept of aging is different than it might have been thought of before, that it's not about being older than 60 or 70, but just being, you know, outside of your early 20s. But most of the participants in our labs are in their 60s and 70s.
And is there an age, though, that you found when the brain, the aging brain, will be more receptive to the training? I mean, is there a cutoff?
Well, it's a great question that we know very little about in terms of the actual details and how plasticity changes across the lifespan. We're comfortable with the fact that I think almost everyone would say that the older adult brain has plasticity, that it might be somewhat reduced, but maybe could be stimulated to be more more plastic, and how it changes on a decade-to-decade basis is still like a very interesting study of area of research. But what's clear is, I mean, we have 70-year-olds that come into our lab, and we can see that they're capable of great change. So, you know, on the plus side, I think that, you know, there's certainly no age where your brain is not plastic anymore. And understanding the factors that can be initiated to encourage and to lead to greater plasticity is really important to understand.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Let me go back to Sofia Vinogradov. You're the chief of mental health at San Francisco VA Medical Center and professor of psychiatry at UCSF. So you're working with patients that have mental health issues. So not like Adam, who's most of his participants have healthy brains.
That's right.
So tell us about the research that you're doing and how it's similar or different from Adam's.
Well, my research has focused on the serious mental illness called schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is a serious psychiatric illness where people experience many changes in how their brain processes information. So they may hear things that aren't really there or see things that aren't really there. In other words, they hallucinate. They may form abnormal memories and interpretations of memories, such as delusional thinking. They might believe there's a conspiracy against them, or they might have an abnormal memory of something that they feel happened to them in the past, where they were unjustly persecuted by the FBI, for example, when there's no evidence for that. And they often have distortions also in sensations in their body. And many other even more subtle changes in how the brain normally should be processing information. And there are some similarities in the aging brain in that we see evidence that, as we do in aging, that some of the ways in which the brain takes in information from its environment and then makes sense of it or interprets it is degraded or no longer operating with the same kind of clarity and fidelity that it does in a young, healthy person. And we see some elements of this in aging as well. Of course, in schizophrenia, we see these changes happening, you know, much, much earlier in life. Actually, even there's evidence that the changes are starting to happen before the person gets the full onset of the illness. So a youngster who is very high risk, say genetically at high risk, or showing clinical problems at high school, having trouble functioning, for example, right before they actually have the full onset of the schizophrenia, they will be showing changes, subtle, but still changes nonetheless in how the brain normally takes in information and processes it. And what we've been studying is trying to find ways to help this impaired brain become a better information processing machine, so to speak. So it's the notion that we can figure out what are the neural systems, and by neural systems I mean kind of the networks or the groups of neurons of nerve cells in the brain which are not working properly, kind of like a muscle that's gotten very weak or never grew properly to begin with. We can figure out which are the ones that are malfunctioning, and then we can have the brain engage in exercises, brain fitness exercises, if you will, just as we would try to exercise a weak muscle or muscle that never developed properly.
So
the way
we
do this, again, very similar to some of the techniques that Adam is using in his laboratory, is through computerized exercises. They sort of look like video games. And in these games or exercises, we ask the individual, in other words, the individual's brain, to listen to many different kinds of stimuli under different conditions and learn to make better and better and finer distinctions around those stimuli, or to look and watch different visual stimuli and perform exercises where they get better and better at discriminating and responding to visual stimuli and many other such sorts of exercises. And we now have evidence both in terms of seeing how people improve in the different measures that we can take, as well as, again, similar to what Adam does, taking different kinds of neuroimaging kinds of measures, of pictures of the brain before and after the training of people with schizophrenia. And we can see that the brain is starting to normalize or move in the direction of showing more normal patterns of activation when it's doing its information processing tasks.
Very interesting, Sofia. Let me ask you a couple of follow-up questions. So first of all, do all schizophrenic brains look alike?
There's quite a lot of variability from individual to individual, just as there is for people who don't have schizophrenia. But there are definitely certain patterns that we see emerging over and over again in terms of these brain processing or information processing abnormalities in schizophrenia.
And so with that being said, in terms of the activities, do some work with some patients better than others?
Well, we definitely see that different patients will respond in different ways. In our studies, about two-thirds of people will show some significant improvement, and about one-third will not. We are trying to figure out what's different about the people who respond to the training and those who don't. We have some early evidence that it's related to just some individual differences in how good of a learner their brain is. You know, each brain sort of has its own learning capacity. We also have some evidence, early evidence, that we're still exploring that suggests that some genetic factors can play a role as well.
So then another thing you mentioned sort of made me wonder, so if you can do imaging to know what a schizophrenic brain looks like, and you see it even before, you know, maybe they've had the breakdown, is it possible for children like this to do kind of exercises and activities and thus prevent schizophrenia?
That's a great question. And in fact, we've asked ourselves the exact same question, and we have a study underway right now to examine that. It's possible to identify in adolescents, young people, before they get schizophrenia, some really high-risk warning signs that they experience in terms of some of their behaviors and kinds of symptoms. So we would never say that they have schizophrenia, but we would say they're having a lot of warning signs. And we have a study going right now at UCSF where we're offering this neuroplasticity-based training or brain fitness exercises to these young people with the hope that it will actually make the brain work better enough so that their risk for actually getting the schizophrenia is greatly reduced.
Okay, that's fantastic. Well, let me move on to Annette Yurok. Annette, you are a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University, and you focus on emotional regulation.
Correct.
So emotional regulation is kind of a combination of things in the normal brain as well as things in the non-normal brain, correct?
Yes, that's exactly. So our approach is a little bit more broader than Sophia's and Adam's, I would say. We know from basic neuroscience research that emotion regulation is this general ability that breaks down very frequently in psychiatric disorders. So we take a so-called cross-diagnostic approach where we try to improve emotion regulation, this ability to deal with emotions, to improve on one's emotion, to regulate one's emotion. So we invite participants who have psychiatric disorders, generalized anxiety disorder, or major depressive disorder, or have encountered some significant trauma in their lives, for example, and developed a PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, as a result of that. And we know that these three disorders are very heavily characterized by emotion regulatory difficulties. These patients have difficulties ramping up positive emotions, reducing their negative emotions. So we use targeted, tuned, computerized games, very much in the same vein as Adam, as Sophia does, to improve the brain's general ability to regulate thoughts and feelings. And we are looking at outcome measures, partly in the realm of neuroimaging, using functional magnetic resonance imaging to see if neural efficiency during emotion regulation is improved as a result of these targeted and tuned brain games. And we're also looking at behavioral outcomes, how well they are doing, how whether their symptoms are reduced, and in general, how they're functioning in their lives.
So when you look at the brain of someone with that is suffering from anxiety or depression, does it look different? The image looks different than someone
normal,
who's not, the normal
healthy brain. There's imaging evidence to show that emotion regulation breaks down in these disorders.
Okay, and have you found that that is a state which generally is not always, you know, is it something that can change? As you mentioned, trauma can bring it on. So can similar things, can people get rid of this stressful brain, this depressed brain, or is it something that's permanent? Or I guess we're talking about plasticity, so it's not really permanent, but you know what I mean? Is it something that is just a characteristic of the brain itself that's maybe been there since childhood?
Well, that's a chicken or egg problem that's really difficult to answer at this point because there's very little research that would be doing this longitudinally in order to answer this question. We would need to follow people from childhood into adulthood and then track their trauma experiences. And these studies are very challenging to conduct. And
okay, so you really, yeah.
So unfortunately, the short answer is we don't know.
Okay.
So what we have is the brain, the anxious person, and we know that behaviorally they have a lot of difficulty. We also know that their brain functions differently. And we also know that through these targeted games and exercises, they are able to improve on their experiences. But we've also had many wonderful tools like psychopharmacology, therapy, essentially does the same thing, tunes the brain. But this hasn't really been looked at in terms of in terms of plasticity. So that's another really exciting area of research.
That's fantastic. Well, let me just, if you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing neuroplasticity and cognitive training with the brain. My guests are Dr. Adam Ghazali, Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry at UCSF and the Director of Neuroscience Imaging Center, the Neuroscience Imaging Center, Joe Hardy, Vice President of Research and Development at Lumos Labs, Sophia Vinogradov, the Chief of Mental Health Service at San Francisco VA Medical Center and Professor of Psychiatry at UCSF, and Annette Urach, a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University, whose research interests are focused on emotion regulation and its neurological, physiological, and behavioral components. If you'd like to join us here, here's the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I'm curious if listeners could give me a call and let me know if they would be willing to put in energy to improve their cognitive fitness, or if they, and what they think of what the research that's been done so far. Give me a call. Again, the number is 415-841-4134, or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So I'd like to go to my next guest, Joe Hardy. You're kind of at the helm of what all these people are talking about. You're actually building the games, doing the research, and then building the games, if I understand, for a lot of the research that's here.
Yeah, we excuse me. At Lumos Labs, we make the website Lumosity, which is a very popular cognitive training website, and we work with a lot of researchers all over the world to study the impacts of cognitive training on cognitive enhancement and cognitive performance in normal, healthy people and also in patient groups as well.
And so, patient groups are?
Different groups, people suffering from mild cognitive impairment, schizophrenia, patients who have survived childhood cancers, post-traumatic stress disorder. We're working with Annette and her anxiety groups. And just in general, you know, we think of it as sort of like we're building the gym. And if you were to go to the gym to, get physical therapy, for example, because you've got some problem, you might be using a lot of the same equipment that you would use if you went to the gym just to work out to improve yourself. So we think of these processes as being quite similar across a lot of these different conditions, but also for normal, healthy people who just want to be a little bit smarter, a little bit sharper. Perform better at school, perform better at work, that sort of thing. So that's our focus, is really building cognitive training programs that are accessible, engaging, and effective that lots and lots of people want to use. Currently, there's about 14 million users worldwide who are engaged with the website. So,
and how are the people that are engaged in the website, are they generally aging people or young people, or
there's a whole spectrum of people across the age range. We have users all the way from 7 to 103 and you know, everywhere in between. So lots and lots of different people coming to it for different reasons.
103? So. Wait a minute. Are you sure? Well, that sounds a little extreme. Maybe they made a typo.
There are definitely people who say that they're 103.
Okay, I
haven't met them in person. So, but no, I mean, there's a 14 million people. It's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people.
But different people come to it for different reasons. A young person, in their 20s might come to it because they are smart and they want to be even smarter. They're really engaged in thinking and being a smart person, and they want to do everything that they can do to enhance themselves. Another person might come to it because they feel like, well, I've never really been able to remember names and faces, and it's really important for me for my job to remember people's names when I meet them and be able to say hi to them and say their name correctly the next time I see them. And then older adults might come to it because they're starting to feel like, maybe they aren't as sharp as they once were, and maybe they see some of their friends, who have retired and, aren't necessarily as sharp as they feel like they once were, and they don't want to be that person. And, there's all different reasons why people come to it. But for the most part, it can kind of all be encompassed by the idea of enhancement, cognitive enhancement, getting better from wherever your starting point is. That's what it's really all about.
So when these different researchers come to you and they say, we need some activities, how do you personalize, the general structure of your games to meet the needs of the different groups? For example, with Annette.
Annette can speak to her research herself, but
did you pick? You made the game.
What we can do is we have a lot of tools for researchers that we try to make it very easy and straightforward for researchers to use our tools, and we can take a lot of the different activities. Again, sort of use the gym analogy. We can take these different pieces of equipment and arrange them in different ways to be targeted for the outcome that's desired in the particular study. So, for example, if we're interested in emotion regulation, we might choose a lot of games that engage so-called executive functions of the brain, the ability to that sort of top-down process that controls your cognition and emotion, and compile these into a program that's specifically designed for that study.
So you must have a very good understanding of what parts of the brain react to different kinds of activities, if you will, right?
Yeah, so certainly we think about targeting different parts of the brain, just in a sort of a circuit training mentality where you march around the brain and exercise different parts of the brain as though they were different muscles of the body. And so we think a lot about exercising all of the different parts of the brain as much as possible. At the same time, what people are really interested in is behavior. So
right.
They're really interested in getting better at something. And so we try to think about measuring, asking people about what they'd like to be better at, and then measuring whether they're actually getting better at it or not.
That's fantastic. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Lauren Meltzer. If you're just tuning in, we're discussing neuroplasticity research here in the Bay Area and how researchers are using games, activities, and training to help many kinds of brain-related issues. Joining me tonight are Dr. Adam Ghazali, Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry at UCSF and the Director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center, Joe Hardy, Vice President of Research and Development at Lumos Labs, Sophia Vinogradov, the Chief of Mental Health Service at San Francisco VA Medical Center and Professor of Psychiatry at UCSF, and Annette Yurok, a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University. Her research includes focusing on emotion regulation and its neurological, physiological, and behavioral components. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134 or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Again, the number is 415-841-4134. I'm curious if you have tried any games or if there's any reason you haven't tried any of the games, give us a call. And let me go to my first caller. I'd like to take our first caller for this evening. We have an anonymous call from San Francisco on line one. Welcome. Thank you for calling in.
Hi. That's okay, anonymous. I something like that. Yes, I try to not. It's very complicated. And first off, I wouldn't mind doing some of these studies. I often thought I could be very interesting research-wise because I've survived a lot. I have family. I love them, my family of origin. I keep a distance. I've been through a lot with them. In particular, an oldest brother, a combat vet, and the youngest, my only sister, she lives in Texas far away. How do you determine if someone authentically has possibly, bipolar would be mild, maybe, I'm not sure, but possible paranoid schizophrenic? She'll fly into rages and she'll accuse me, usually on the telephone. I have about 70 messages from a couple years past of being yelled at, belittled, criticized, accused of things I wouldn't think to do.
Let me. I think you brought up a really good question.
How do you determine if they're faking it?
Sophia,
really?
Let me go to you. What?
Sure, I'm happy to answer that. So there are many, many different things that can happen that can cause the kinds of erratic behavior, erratic and agitated behavior that you're describing. And those can range indeed from schizophrenia or bipolar illness, but also intoxication with substances, other problems going on in the brain. So the way we make the diagnosis is by a thorough examination by a skilled practitioner who will meet with the person in question, get their history, do any medical workup that needs to happen, and examine them. So that's the way we make the diagnoses of either a psychiatric illness or intoxication or a medical problem in the brain causing agitated behavior, when we see it occurring.
Okay. And let me move on to Judith from Sunnyvale. Judith, you have also kind of suffered trauma, is that right?
Hi. Yes. I call it living with PTSD for maybe 50 years or so, only I didn't know it until about 10 years ago. And so I've been kind of going through life more or less terrified of people and things and so on. And after many years of therapy from a really gifted provider, I started developing some tricks for myself. So, for example, it's really difficult for me to remember the name of a person I've met. And so we kind of figured that one reason was anxiety. So 90% of my brain was being afraid, and only 10% was there for the name. So I try to conjure up a positive association with a person, like I like their hairstyle or the color they're wearing or almost anything. And that helps me remember their name. And I'm wondering if that's in line with your findings.
Okay, well, thank you. Has that helped you, Judith, just out of curiosity?
Yes, very much. Actually, well, it certainly makes the anxiety diminish a lot.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, Annette. I mean, are those the kind of tricks in your activities that you do in your games?
Yeah, that's actually consistent with some of the approaches that we're taking. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences, Judith. So some of our games, what we're doing is we're helping people to tune in on positive aspects of their interactions. So what Judith is describing is very common in PTSD, this upsurge of anxiety that sort of disables people and prevents them from functioning normally in social situations. And one of the games that we're using in our protocol is helping our patients tune in on positive information instead of focusing on negative information. So these attentional training games where people find positive words or positive, think of positive thoughts repeatedly, we find that this actually helps reduce their anxiety levels. Yeah.
So I'm curious, and this is a question to all of you, but maybe we'll start off, with you, Adam. Are the kinds of changes that you see in the brain and the aging brain, are they permanent once the participants have played the game for a certain amount of time or the activities? Or do they disappear like someone who hasn't gone to the gym for a long time if they stop
It's a good question. It's a very important issue in this whole field of research is what we call sustainability. How long do these effects last? It's hard to study that because they're longitudinal studies, so they demand the resources to bring people back and check them. A lot of it depends on what it is. So, there's two main types of interventions, I would say. One is strategies where you learn a trick or a certain thing that you do every time you're trying to remember something. And that is very helpful. There has been some question on how long that type of learning lasts. It might differ depending on what type of strategy you're learning. The other type of learning is more similar to some of the topics we're talking about, where we call plasticity-based learning. And basically what that involves is practicing something again and again and again until your brain actually changes and performs whatever you're doing more efficiently. And there's definitely data that that does last a while. Some studies have shown even for over a year. In the end, I think that anything to be maintained well is going to require some type of reinforcement, similar to how we expect that from physical fitness, that we know we need to boost that that training that we got periodically. And how much we need to do that is still a really open-ended question. And what type of interventions have the best sustainability is very important, because you don't want to basically be chained to a game all day. And, you want to be able to have some lasting benefits. So it's a great question that we're all really interested in. I know all of us are very, curious about that.
Okay. And you want to add that?
Yeah, I want to add that I think above and beyond sustainability, what's the most interesting question for me is how much people can transfer over these skills that they practice in the games into their everyday lives, and how that skill then sustains itself. So we actually have evidence that when people play these games, they improve their concentration, they improve their focusing abilities, and this sort of acts as a snowball, so to say, and 3-4 months down the road, they actually have better well-being, and they build up these basic underlying skills that will then translate into better abilities socially and maybe academically, and that will then improve their general functioning. So I think that transfer question and the sustainability of transfer is one of the most important areas here.
Joe Hardy, let me go to you. So are there, in terms of the transferability and the sustainability, have you found that games which focus on emotion versus cognitive have better staying power, if you will?
I can't really answer that directly. We don't have comparisons between those two types of activities in terms of how the sustainability works. But and to Adam's point, these studies are take a long time to run, so there's not so much data out there. But there is some really compelling data that says that the kind of brain plasticity based cognitive training programs, like what we're talking about, the effects of those can be impactful in everyday life, and that impact can last even up to 5 years. So, for example, in one study, people who went through cognitive training were less likely to get in an auto accident for 5 years out after the training of just 10 hours. The ability to do the activities of everyday life was improved for that period of time as well. So you can see that, improving some of these core abilities does more than just make you better at, clinical-based tests, but it actually helps you in your everyday life.
I'd just like to add to what Joe was saying. He's mentioning studies that were done with older adults, and that was quite remarkable that just a short course of some speed of processing training could result in such improved outcomes, like reduced accidents from driving, 5 years out, also better health outcomes and the like. What I wanted to add is that in schizophrenia, we've seen that a strong relationship between those people who make the strongest gains from the training and show the most cognitive improvement after training, when we follow up with them 6 months later, these are the people who are showing the most improved quality of life in terms of their, daily activities. So as Annette was suggesting, we see this positive snowball effect where people who make gains from the training, and as their brain becomes, in a sense, more sharply tuned, more efficient, they go out into the real world, and now they're able to have more kind of adaptive interactions and more positive functioning out in the world, and it begins to feed upon itself in this kind of positive upward spiral. So we've seen that in schizophrenia as well.
That's interesting. I want to go back to both you and Annette for a question, but let me first say, if you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing neuroplasticity research here in the Bay Area and how researchers are using games and training to help many kinds of brain-related issues. And joining me are Dr. Adam Ghazali, Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry at UCSF and the Director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center, Dr. Joe Hardy, Vice President of Research and Development at Lumos Labs, Sophia Vinogradov, the Chief of Mental Health Service at San Francisco VA Hospital, VA Medical Center, and the Professor of Psychiatry at UCSF, and Annette Urach, a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University. If you'd like to join us, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or join us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Again, I love to hear from you and hear your stories, either with your memory or cognitive functioning, you know, areas that you feel would be helpful to have activities. Maybe that would be interesting for Joe to hear. Again, the number is 415-841-4134, or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So one question that I had, and we actually just got an email in regards to this. We got an email from Tony, I'm going to kind of paraphrase a little bit what he said, but basically he thinks he suffers from some blood phobia, which he acquired when he was a child, and he faints when he sees or thinks about blood or someone getting injured or having some serious injuries or surgeries. And he wants to get treatment, but he was wondering, he said that medication makes him very tired and sleepy, and he wants to know if there's, you know, some sort of game or activity which, you know, he could undergo, maybe a 12-step program, if you will, to be able to get rid of the problem permanently without needing to take medication. And I was kind of curious, both Sophia and Annette, you know, if indeed the patients that you have or the participants you have, if they are doing this, if they can either not take medication or go down with their medication because the medication would do similar things. And, you know, Annette, why don't I start with you?
Yeah, sure. Obviously, without knowing the full details of his problem, it's difficult to recommend any specific training program. As far as reducing medication and using this treatment modality, cognitive training as sort of a complementary treatment modality, we definitely see a lot of promise and a lot of excitement in that area. We know that psychopharmacology can dramatically improve anxiety symptoms, depression symptoms, but we also know that a lot of people, just like Tony, just like this person who emailed, have many adverse side effects. So in terms of individualized medicine, this is definitely a very promising area of research that people might want to try to see if they improve on this, and then complement maybe the therapy that they are partaking in or the psychiatric medications that they are on.
Okay. And Sophia, what have you found? I mean, schizophrenia clearly is something you don't mess around with when it comes to medication.
Right. We actually have not in our studies tried to reduce medications when people are doing this training. We try to kind of keep things very even. We have, interestingly enough, found some evidence that, in fact, a certain aspect of the medications, or some medications that are taken for schizophrenia that are known to block the functioning of certain receptors in the brain, in particularly acetylcholine. These are called anticholinergic side effects of these medications. We have found, not surprisingly, if you know the basic neuroscience, that there is a relationship between the amount of kind of anticholinergic side effects that someone might have from their medications, and a lack of ability to respond to the training. So this is an example of where some of the medications that someone might be taking might actually make it more difficult for their brain to respond to the plasticity-based training because of the effects that the medications are having on the brain. So we're beginning to find that this is going to be a very complex field, one in which traditional medications that are out there need to be looked at very carefully and thoughtfully. And of course, as you know, in schizophrenia, we have to be very thoughtful around medications because they really do offer so many benefits for so many people. But at the same time, I think it indicates that we need to be making a real push to develop different kinds of medications and different combinations of medications that will allow someone to have symptom relief from the troubling serious symptoms such as hallucinations and delusions, and yet still allow their brain to be very responsive to the cognitive training.
Okay. Let me go back to you, Adam. You do a lot with the imagery, and I'm curious. I heard somewhere that Einstein had a larger brain than other people. Do you see that? I mean, can you see that brains change in size when you do the imaging and see, I guess, the brains that have been doing different kinds of activities?
Yeah, there's actually a surprising amount of data recently that show that different brain structures change through this phenomenon of neuroplasticity with repetitive practice. So there are some really nice papers showing changes in the brain due to things like juggling, just a repetitive test like that, or even things like meditation. There's a rather famous study showing that London taxi drivers who have to learn these very complicated routes before they get their license, like 2 years of training, have larger areas in their brain, an area known as the hippocampus, which is involved in memory. So I think that a lot of us suspected that the type of changes that would occur associated with plasticity would be functional, physiological changes, changes in the level of chemicals, neurotransmitters. But we see that that's not only the case, that there are actual size changes in the brain. What these mean on a cellular level is still an open question, but we know that the adult brain is capable of generating new neurons, at least in some particular areas of the brain, like the hippocampus, and that we know that the neurons, the nerve cells, have these branches that look like branches on a tree that are capable of having new branches form when they're stimulated or in a stimulating environment. So, yes, there are changes in the size and the structure of the brain due to neuroplasticity.
Okay, and we have an email from Michelle, and she wants to know if there's any difference between a woman's aging brain and men's.
Huh, that's an interesting question. Well, there's actually not a ton of gender data on aging and neural mechanisms and cognition. So far in most of our studies, we haven't had enough participants from both female and male subgroups to look at differences, and it's something that we're looking at right now. There's so many individual differences between people that it usually overcomes things like gender differences, but it's a good question, something that we're looking at.
Okay, and Joe, you want to add to that?
Yeah, we have a database of hundreds of millions of activities that people have played on Lumosity.com, and you can see performance differences as a function of age, gender, and all kinds of different other characteristics. And so, people are very interested in this issue of gender differences. So we took some time out recently to explore a little bit the differences between men and women's performance as they age. Well, one of the things that you notice is that women age better in general, right? So they tend to live longer. And so, as that kind of plays out throughout the whole aging process. But it's also just interesting that men and women are a little bit different in terms of their cognitive abilities on average, but it's not that big of a difference. So, for example, women tend to be a little bit better at a task of verbal fluency, so the ability to come up with words, a lot of different words. And then men tend to be a little bit better at arithmetic, speeded arithmetic. But if you look at that, the differences within the genders are so much larger than the differences across the genders. And with a little bit of training, just a few sessions of training, the average woman can get way above where the average man starts. So through training and plasticity, all these things, all these small differences can be easily overcome.
Well, I have a lot of people calling in, so let me try to get to some of these questions. First, we have Ed from Menlo Park. Hi, Ed.
Hi, good evening. It's been interesting to listen to the discussion. I'm a blind individual here. My mother has Lewy cell dementia, and my sister has Hashimoto's, which caused her to have a bout of schizophrenia. And I'm wondering, I don't think these computer-based exercises are accessible to the blind. So what about dietary supplements or diet or exercise?
That's a good question. Or, you know, are there games that are accessible to the blind, Joe?
I don't know of any commercially available, very accessible games, but I know that there are people working on them. There are a lot of other things that we can do to improve our cognition and stay healthy in terms of our brain. Eating a heart-healthy diet is important, so foods that are high in antioxidants, omega-3 fatty acids are thought to be good. They're good for the heart, so you know it's the fact that they're good for the brain is a nice added benefit as well. Staying socially connected, social networks are very important. One of the most stimulating things you can do as a human being is to engage with other human beings. Staying in touch with old friends, again, it's a great way to improve your mood as well as keep your brain healthy. And physical exercise is known to be important for your whole body, and your brain is an important organ in your body. Perhaps the most important, and so it also benefits from exercise physically.
Okay, thank you.
Does anyone know whether the Lewy cell dementia is inheritable? Do I need to worry?
Anyone here?
I mean, Lewy body dementia, for the most part, is usually sporadic. As for most dementias, they occur in so many people as they get older that. Unless it's a very particular type, you shouldn't be at much increased risk. But I would need more information about your family history to know for sure. But I don't think that there should be any great immediate concern just by knowing that someone in your family had that.
Thank you so much, Ed, for calling in. Let me go to Anne from San Francisco. Good evening, Anne.
Hi, I had heard that if you are if you're engaged on a day-to-day basis, for example, if you're continuing to work, that doing cognitive training exercises wasn't an added benefit over just your day-to-day activities. And I'm wondering if the speakers agree with that.
Thank you. Joe?
I think that is not really an accurate representation of the data at this point. It's certainly true that being engaged in day-to-day activities and your job and being just engaged with hobbies and other sorts of things that are mentally stimulating are important and beneficial. But it's also true that direct stimulation in targeted ways, in ways that are adaptive and engaging, and really critically novel experiences are important for maintaining cognitive functioning throughout the age, throughout the lifespan, and. One of the things that's true is that no matter where you are, you could always be a little bit better. And if that's of interest to you, being stronger than, doing some actual, determined exercise is always a good idea.
Well, let me go to Wendy. I'm going to try to get a few more in for the end of the show. Wendy from San Francisco. Good evening, Wendy. And thank you, Anne, for calling in with that other great question. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. I'm a college instructor, and I want to say that at age 58, I can still see some of the benefit that I had when I started doing Brain Fitness. It's a program that I did. It was about a 40-hour program that I did on my own on our computer about 4 years ago. And I had definitely anecdotally, I would say that my memory was markedly better after having done the program. And by the way, I also use Lumosity. What I would find is, as a college instructor, I would teach 9 months, and then I would have the summer off. And when I got to my early 50s, I would find that certain memory tasks were a little bit harder in September than they were, let's say, in February, when I was more engaged and having been at work more months. And so after doing the brain fitness regime, I found that in September, when I went back to the classroom, I found that I did not have that ramp up, and I was remembering certain things in regards to my teaching a lot faster without having to take as many notes to remember, for example, from one seminar class that would meet on Monday, Wednesday, what had happened and who had said what particular thing from Wednesday to the following Monday when class would meet again.
Let me, Wendy, let me just, I hate to cut you off, but we're coming to the end of the show. So let me just ask, I'm curious, Joe, I mean, is there a difference in terms of when, you know, a time of year or...
Well, there's definitely seasonalities.
Seasonality.
But I think what she was just talking about is this effect that's actually really well known in school children. You know, where at the end of this, you know, during those summer months, achievement actually goes down from just 3 months of inactivity in terms of cognitively stimulating activities. So you can see that, you know, being engaged all the time with novel and highly stimulating mental activity is really important.
Well, let me go. Let me just. I'm actually not going to go to Richard, but I will paraphrase his question. He wants to know where you get information for different programs that are available. Richard is going to be the last question that we take tonight. Joe, maybe we start off with you.
Well, you can certainly check out our website, which is www.lumosity.com. We have a lot of information about the science of brain training on there. Of course, Google, if you do a search for brain training or cognitive fitness, you'll see a lot of information there.
And what about you? I know, Annette, you mentioned that people want to get involved. They actually can with one of your studies, right?
Absolutely. If people are interested, I would encourage them to email us at psychiatry@stanford.edu. That is psychiatry, which is psychiatry at stanford.edu. And just leave their names and a good number to call them at, and we're going to get in touch with them.
Okay, great. And Adam, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, in the same vein, we're always recruiting participants for research studies that are in the Bay Area. We have studies on healthy younger adults and older adults. And looking up my last name, Gazzaley, will take you to our website, and there's an email address there. And, you know, we always like engaging local participants in our research.
Okay, wonderful. And I think, Sophia, anything else to add? Or
I would just wanted to add the comment that that's a wonderful question, really, in a sense, asking about what do we know about the relative merits of the different, you know, brain training exercises which are out there right now, because there are a small handful. And the true answer is not much. Various of us have studied various of the programs that are out there or have created some of our own, which we are studying. But the field really is at the point, well, Adam likes to use the term the Wild West, and Adam and I have had this discussion that we don't yet have any real standards or even gold standards on how to determine of the different programs out there which ones are the best for which conditions. As Joe mentioned, probably many of them will end up being good for many different kinds of conditions, but the data really isn't very extensive yet at this point. So I would say to everyone out there, stay tuned. Hopefully we'll be coming up with answers to this, you know, in the coming year or two.
Well, that is a wonderful way to end our program for tonight. I want to thank all of you for being a part of this show. You were fantastic. This is a fantastic show. Dr. Adam Ghazzaley, Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry at UCSF, and the Director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center, Joe Hardy, Vice President of Research and Development at Lumos Labs, Sophia Vinogradov, Chief of Medical Health Service at San Francisco VA Medical Center and Professor of Psychiatry in UCSF, and Annette Urach, a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Thank you so much, Eric. Our live phones were managed by producer City Vision... were producers, City Vision's producer, Susie Britton. City Vision's founder is Rose Levinson. Judith Sanson is our senior producer. And our other contributing producers are Lisa Denmark and Yumi Wilson. Neil Fries manages our website. Join us next week where we'll look at the state of Proposition 8. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.